a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's good to have you along on this Monday morning. And hey, heads up here. Just two more days to go to put up with me covering this show. Lee Lonsberry is in the building, as it were, and is just getting his sea legs and will be on the air in this time slot coming up on Wednesday. It's been fun filling in, but as I promised at the very beginning, this was going to be a temporary thing. It was a little less temporary than I thought. You know, Robin, when I was originally contacted and said, hey, could you help us out for 3 or 4 weeks? That was 3 months ago.
Yeah, never agree.
So, but hey, I said yes, and it's been fun, and you've got a lot to look forward here with Lee Lonsberry coming up beginning on Wednesday. So what's on the program today? Well, we're going to take a quick look at the impeachment update. I watched some of it this morning, and again, this is a difficult thing. First of all, I think whenever I see anybody start going kind of lighthearted on it, or, well, this is just, no, this is serious business. At the very, very best, because I think most of us do believe that this will be, and I'm speaking the best from President Trump's point of view, the best case scenario here for him is that this will be that asterisk that very few presidents have ever had to have on their record, only two in history. Andrew Johnson, and also, of course, President Bill Clinton, have had that label of having been impeached. But never have we convicted a president on the impeachment. Richard Nixon short-circuited that. So the best scenario at this point, I think most of us agree, because there will be a vote on the impeachment. The president, I think, will be impeached. I don't think, barring something that is almost unfathomable, at this point, just because of the partisan nature. I mean, take the issue out of it completely and what is actually being discussed and debated out of it completely. The president's conduct, was it or was it not impeachable? Take that out of it. This totally, absolutely nonpartisan event will end up with a vote for impeachment in the House and end up with an acquittal in the Senate. So the very best that the president, I believe, can hope for is that he will simply be impeached, will not be convicted, and won't be, again, I'm speaking from the president's point of view, won't be damaging enough to hurt his reelection bid. But this is serious business. It truly is on every level. And I've heard a few people just write it off as a big show, and it might be in many ways. But this is, when you talk about impeaching the president of the United States, it's a big deal. And I think that's what's so distressing on every side, for those who truly believe that he did commit an impeachable offense, and for those who truly believe that, yes, some of the actions were unacceptable and even a bit outrageous, but no, they are not impeachable. And then somewhere between that are the people that are just, they don't care. They don't care if he's guilty or not. They just want him in or they want him out. That's it, period. So it's distressing to me, but we'll walk through some of the highlights. And it was interesting, someone by the name of Daniel Goldman this morning made the case, basically, for impeachment before the Judiciary Committee, and he boiled it down to four things, and we'll talk about that coming up in a moment. My friend Pete Ashdown will be joining us, and for those of us who truly believe in historic preservation and hope that where possible, and sometimes it's not, sometimes the structure, sometimes the building, sometimes things just need to change. And sometimes great old buildings need to come down. But is that the case with the Utah Theater? And boy, I'll tell you, because once they're gone, they are gone. I've always used the example of the old Salt Lake Theater. And in 1929, I believe, my great-grandfather was the chairman of the last performance at the Salt Lake Theater. And I think ever since the wrecking ball was put through the side of the wall of the old Salt Lake Theater, people have regretted it. And they've tried to honor that old theater. They have tried to give renditions of the theater. There are monuments there on the side of the building that is now on that site. Up at the University of Utah, there is a modernistic rendition of the old Salt Lake Theater. Up on Capitol Hill, at the Daughters of the Utah Pioneer Museum, it was designed to look like and be reminiscent of the old Salt Lake Theater. Wouldn't it have been something if we had actually preserved that old theater, which was the grandest theater, bar none, between Chicago and San Francisco? It was Brigham Young's pet project. Remember, it was Brigham Young who said that if he were to put one thing into a community that would help to civilize it, wasn't a church, wasn't a temple, it was a theater. And one of the highest priorities for Brigham Young was Social Hall first, which was a community gathering place and a theater, and then the Salt Lake Theater that was built in the 1860s, and it was a marvel in its age, and the finest performers, literally from around the world, performed there. When we knock down the old Utah Theater, that is going to be, first of all, a sad day, but is it going to be one of those irreparable days where we are going to regret it forever? I don't know. The old Utah Theater has been dead for so long, and its grandeur is hidden behind so much. The theater itself is back kind of embedded in the block. You have to go back through the long hallway to go to the grandeur of the old Pantages Theater. And I don't know, we're going to talk with Pete about that. Mayor Jeff Silvestrini out in Mill Creek has a little bit of a historic issue as well with the old meeting house that's up there on Highland Drive. And that is now slated for demolition. And at one time, they were actually looking at the Mill Creek City Hall to be in there. Well, the Russians banned with the formality of the state itself. Now, athletes will be able to participate if they are not branded in a disgrace situation here in the upcoming Olympics. But Russia itself, for 4 years, out. We're going to talk about that. Representative Brad Wilson, Speaker Wilson, will be our guest also. The tax reform package is really taking shape, and we'll chat with him about that. We'll also get the take from the minority on Utah's Capitol Hill in Senator Karen Main. But right now, before we can trudge on this second to last day.
Yeah.
No weeping.
I've been reminiscing.
No tears from me, Argentina.
We need like a montage and some swelling music. And
you know, if I have any more farewells at KSL, they're going to put a mirror under my nose just to, you know, make sure it's really done.
You know what, though? That means you've done a really good job.
Oh, I don't know. Hey, it's been fun.
They won't let you go. All right.
Okay.
As per the usual, I've got a few headlines here. I'm just going to read them off.
Okay.
And let me know what you think. Netflix dominates the Golden Globe nominations.
That's right, and deservingly so.
Do you have any favorites?
Oh, man. You know, I was just going over the list, and this has been kind of a banner year for me because I've seen these movies. And, you know, sometimes it's been hard because there haven't been screenings for them. A lot of them have been kind of artsy, but The Irishman is a Netflix.
I didn't see that yet.
Amazing.
I keep hearing you start when you're 20 and it ends when you are 50. Like it goes on forever.
Yeah. It's a long movie, but it doesn't feel long.
Okay.
And plus, with it being on Netflix, you can kind of put it on hold.
Right.
You know, take a break.
Make
if
it
you
a
need.
Miniseries.
Marriage Story is also a wonderful.
That's the one they. I haven't seen that.
Oh. Adam Driver is incredible. Scarlett Johansson is amazing. The supporting cast. And Two Popes. The Two Popes is delightful. And this is one of those movies, Steve and I have talked about this, you hope that what you're seeing here is really true and really happened. Now we know the overall arc of it did, and the transfer of power in the Catholic Church, and the fact that there are two living popes right now, and so on. But the exchange between these two incredible individuals, and Pope Francis is a favorite of mine, So it is magnificent. And boy, you look down the list and Netflix really, really fared well. And Dolemite Is My Name is also a Netflix that is out there. So yeah, this has been a banner year for them. And you know, Netflix is amazing, but the thing that puzzles us all is how do they, well, they don't make money. They don't.
Now, so many companies these days don't.
And somewhere along the line, they're going to have to.
Yeah, we're not going to get all this. I mean, $7 a month, even $12, it's not that much for what
The whole business model of Netflix is unsustainable at this point.
Yeah.
And I understand flushing money like crazy with an end game, but many of us are asking, where is the end game?
Yeah.
And especially with the Disney Plus and so many Plex, all kinds of things there, HBO Max. I mean, good grief, there, Hulu, you name it, all over the place. Yeah. So that was a long answer to a very short question.
The one I starred isn't a Netflix show, but one of my favorite miniseries was Chernobyl.
Oh,
did you watch that?
Chernobyl.
Chernobyl,
I just saw bits and pieces
of it. It was fantastic. I hope that wins some awards. The acting was really, really well done, and the camera, all the cinematography, everything, that was one of my favorites. So I hope that makes the headlines. All right, this is just a little throwaway, but just so you know, Miss South Africa has been crowned 2019 Miss Universe.
I know. That's very cool.
I used to be really into the pageants when I was a kid. I don't watch them much anymore, but
you know, I remember when I was a kid too, which was a little before you being a kid.
Just a minute.
It was such a big deal. The Miss America, of course, you know, we had three channels to watch back then, and if one had the Miss America pageant on it, it had more than its fair share of viewers, and everybody knew who Miss America was. You know, you could name it.
She was a celebrity.
You could go up to the average person. She'd be on all the shows and everything else. And now, how many people could name who Miss America is right now?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah. No, I'd have to Google it. Yeah, and I was surprised to see they still have said she went through a round of swimsuits and evening gowns.
Yeah.
They still do all the classic, and then they do the social issues and answer questions and things. But
especially with the Miss World stuff, you know, they too. And, you know, you look, our president had a role with Miss World. And so, anyway.
Now, had I had some foresight on this, I would have asked Gustavo to pull up the X-Files theme, because we call it the Miss Universe pageant, but that's just assuming that this is that we're the only ones in the universe. But, you know, it's a little presumptuous to say this.
Nobody from outside of the universe
has entered the race.
Or of the known universe has ever participated. Yeah.
I always take umbrage with the fact they call it the universe, not the world. Anyway, that's just me.
A swimsuit competition on that could be kind of unique.
It could be. Interesting fashion choices. Okay, the average U.S. price of gas has dropped 1 penny per gallon to $2.65 a gallon is the average price. That's probably good for you truck drivers. You have a big truck, right?
I have a small truck. Well, an F-150.
Oh, okay.
That would have been considered a big truck back in the old days, but not anymore. Not when you have
the monsters.
250, 350.
Yeah. You just have a penny per gallon right now. It just dropped one penny.
Wow.
There you go.
Is that on a top tier fuel?
I don't know. It doesn't say.
Tier three?
I know. Just says, I think it's probably, regular grade gasoline. So I'm assuming unleaded.
Regular grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Last on my list, because it's Christmas season. Doug, what is on your Christmas list this year?
On my Christmas list this year?
What do you want Santa to bring down the chimney for Doug Wright?
I want a new tool bench for Eureka.
There we go. Santa, you hear that?
Santa is going to go for it. And then, of course, I want peace and love and harmony. And
Someone else will ask for that. Ask for the big stuff.
I want as we talked about the other day, my mom's white fruit cake. You know, just, you know.
These are simple requests. Santa can do this.
Yep.
You can bring it.
By the way, my grandson made his first trip to Eureka over the weekend.
Did he like it?
Oh, absolutely. He was raving about it.
He raised his little baby hand. And
he was raving about it.
Fist pumped.
Yeah, fist pumped and, you know, did all the things babies do, which I'm assuming meant approval.
Right. Yep. Awesome. Well, we're done. We're done on my end over here.
Did I survive?
As always, you passed with flying colors. I don't know how you do it day after day.
You're only going to be able to pick on me one more day.
Tomorrow will have to be a doozy.
Yeah.
Watch out.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Let's take a break.
Drink your Ovaltine.
Yeah. Okay, Ovaltine. You know what my secret Annie Dakota ring says? Drink more Ovaltine. No wonder little Ralphie was bummed out. All right, let's take a break, and we'll be right back here at KSL.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
It is so good to have you along, and I wanted to share just a little bit of what is unfolding back in Washington, D.C. And I had an interesting conversation over the weekend, a very dear friend of mine, and the conversation was kind of private, but I'll just reiterate a few things of what he said. He has a very artistic temperament. As a matter of fact, he's an amazing artist. And I was chatting with him. And he said that what has been unfolding politically at almost every level has been so distressing to him that it was actually inhibiting his creativity. He said he really had to go through some reflection and, based on his religious beliefs, just really try to kind of gather himself back together. And he indicated to me that he has always loved politics and always enjoyed talking about politics, but now not so much. And I can relate to that. Ever since I was a teenager, I've loved talking about politics. I've been fascinated with politics. I owe a great deal of that to some wonderful people that were my mentors, going clear back to my grandfather, who always chaired the Republican Party in his neighborhood. Voting occurred at his house. I ran the campaign for Jim Girard, who was running for the Utah State Legislature. We did not win that race, by the way. But I was very young when I helped him with his campaign. And I had a wonderful teacher at Granite High School, actually in the evening school, if you want me to be precise. I've always told you that I was somewhat of a problem child. I liked working a whole lot more than I liked going to school. But this teacher, she was amazing. She truly was, and she really got me fired up, and I wrote all kinds of articles on the 1972 election at that time. I had a great teacher who always put us in an awkward position. You know, he got to know the kids fairly well, and whenever he asked us to, and this was not a debate class, but to make the case for or debate a particular point of view, he would always assign us what we knew was not necessarily our comfort zone. I thank him to this day for that. I've always loved politics. But, you know, the last little while, it has not been fun. It has not been enlightening. It has not been even uplifting. It has been soul-sucking. And that's fundamentally what this dear friend of mine said over the weekend. And my heart kind of ached for him because he is so amazing. He is truly a gifted artist. And when I thought that just the vibes, basically, I'll use an old term, just the vibes had him so, and I'll use it, bummed out, that it was hampering his life. It was hampering his creativity. And fortunately, he had the tools and the wherewithal to kind of rally himself. And I think we've all been, to one degree or another, in that position. There have been so many days I just haven't wanted to turn on TV or listen to media or anything. I just, and especially with just how nasty it is right now, how, and he used this word and it's right, how crass it is, how base it is. And, you know, at least in the day when we were discussing some pretty tough stuff, there'd be something kind of uplifting and you'd go, wow, now that was inspirational. And anyway, so it kind of got my attention. So anyway, this morning I was watching the proceedings going on back in Washington, and it was interesting. This is the Democratic attorney, Dan Goldman, who at the very end of quite a long presentation, he gave a little summary of what he saw as the impeachment evidence that was uncovered by the committee.
The extensive evidence that the committee's uncovered during this investigation led to the following critical findings. First, President Trump used the power of his office to pressure and induce the newly elected president of Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 presidential election for President Trump's personal and political benefit. Second, in order to increase the pressure on Ukraine to announce the politically motivated investigations that President Trump wanted, President Trump withheld a coveted Oval Office meeting and $391 of essential military assistance from Ukraine. Third, President Trump's conduct sought to undermine our free and fair elections and poses an imminent threat to our national security. And fourth, faced with the revelation of his pressure campaign against Ukraine, President Trump directed an unprecedented effort to obstruct Congress's impeachment inquiry into his conduct.
Well, obviously that was the Democratic point of view, and since that we have heard some Republican point of view, some back and forth, and it was interesting too that Daniel Goldman, in the course of the conversation or his presentation this morning, made the point several times that President Trump did not really care about the corruption, did not really care about investigation. What he really cared about was the announcement of investigation that would somehow taint a political opponent. We've got another little sound right here that the president persisted continuing the effort to coerce a foreign country.
President Trump's persistent and continuing effort to coerce a foreign country to help him cheat to win an election is a clear and present danger to our free and fair elections and to our national security.
Obviously, again, you are hearing the Democrats' presentation on this, and I'm going to leave you just with the back and forth that went up. You know, this is kind of the he said, she said, as it were.
I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment, because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do.
Every fact alleged by the whistleblower has been substantiated by multiple witnesses, again and again.
To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over eight lines in a call transcript is baloney.
It is clear and overwhelming that in abusing that power, the president betrayed the national interest by putting his own political prospects over the national security of our country.
Well, it went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and we'll just continue to keep an eye on it. But that's just a little of the flavor of what unfolded this morning. And when we come back, the old Utah Theater, we're going to talk about that. We're already getting some texts on this. How do you feel about Salt Lake City basically giving away the Utah Theater, and we'll have some really cool condos and things in downtown Salt Lake City? We'll talk with Pete Ashdown next.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Just checking the texts a moment ago on our Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line, and One indicated, I am 55 years old, the texter said, and went to many, many movies at the old Utah Theater when I was growing up. I'd really hate to see it torn down. Yeah, I think many of us feel exactly that way. Another texter, when I was rehearsing a bit of what unfolded in Washington this morning, please talk about something else. There is surely something positive and newsworthy that could be discussed instead of politics. Oh, there are other things, no doubt about it. I'm not sure if this is going to be uplifting and positive, because we're going to talk about what appears to be the death knell of the old Utah Theater. I was reading the article that was on KSL.com, and it's one of the opening lines is, and this is from David Berg, an organizer with Save the Utah Theater, "It's disheartening and it's disgusting, honestly." Well, what has happened? The Salt Lake City Council, acting as the city's redevelopment agency board, voted Tuesday to greenlight a $4 million write-down for the sales price of the property, effectively giving it to a developer planning to raise the 101-year-old theater and replace it with a 30-story, 300-apartment skyscraper. The 5-2 vote came after some council members empathized with the supporters, but they felt the RDA board's hands were somewhat tied after the mayor signed an agreement last month to sell the property. And it was Councilman Chris Wharton said, "Sadly, our vote today is not whether to save the theater." And he said that when they actually went through the theater, he saved a piece of the rubble because he wanted a reminder that when he worked forward to exhaust every option to preserve historical buildings. Wow. Another person who has worked very hard on this, valiantly on this, has been Pete Ashdown. And Pete joins us on the line today. And is there a final stake through the heart? Was this the silver bullet?
I can't see any way around it, Doug, and it's primarily the fault lies with the mayor. The mayor signed the sales contract without any public input and any open discussion, and the city council acting as the RDA board had their hands effectively tied by that decision. Now, Mayor Biscupsy has not been a real friend to preservation throughout her term, and on top of that, the entire negotiations for the sale of Utah Theater has been a closed process, in that they've been exclusively negotiating with property owners to the south and the north of the Utah Theater, and nobody else. And the initial owner to the south bought into the property in the same year that he started exclusive negotiations with the RDA, and it never changed. He walked in and said that he was going to restore the theater, and then decided he couldn't, and his term expired, and then the RDA renewed it again and again, and subsequently here we are today with them saying they can't restore the theater, and nobody else being given the chance to restore the theater.
Wow. And the sad thing, Pete, as you and I have talked about before, I alluded to this earlier with several other old buildings that now we long for, we try to recreate, like the old Salt Lake Theater. We've tried to recreate it with the Daughters of the Utah Pioneer Museum, at least the facade and the overall look, a more modernistic look at what the Salt Lake Theater used to look like up now at the University of Utah. We've put monuments up. We've done all kinds of things, but wouldn't it have been wonderful if we actually had saved it? And now we're looking at knocking over one of the most historic movie theaters, not only in our state or in the Intermountain West, but in the entire country. And, you know, Pete, you said something that kind of really got my attention. It wasn't all that long ago that the Other Side Academy was working very, very hard. As a matter of fact, one of my bucket list broadcasts before I wrapped up the old Doug Wright Show a year and a half or so ago was over there as we finally, there was this dilapidated, terrible old building that was literally falling down. It had caught fire on the inside. To even go inside the building was a danger to life and limb. Homeless people had gone in there, and I'll put this as delicately as I can, any kind of waste that you can imagine was in there. All kinds of, you know, drug paraphernalia. The walls were, again, literally falling down around our ears. And to try to get the permit to knock that thing over was incredible. And again, a lot of it went back to the mayor's office. It just went on and on and on. And now I look at this and I look at how relatively just all of a sudden, yeah, well, let's sell it and we'll just knock that puppy over. It's kind of the tale of two properties here.
Yeah, and there have been examples all over the country of theaters that, grand theaters and grand movie theaters that were in worse condition that were successfully salvaged and restored. What is especially sad for me about this, Doug, is that I've had a front row seat to the destruction of many theaters in Salt Lake. I saw Star Wars at the Center Theater, and as a kid in high school, I managed to get into the property as they were demolishing it, and was just stunned to see the beautiful murals that were on the wall. As the chair of the Utah Heritage Foundation, which is now Preservation Utah, we got to see the inside of the Promise Valley Playhouse before they decided to turn that into a parking garage. And, of course, the Regency and Villa Theater were theaters that I had great memories of. And literally, the Utah Theater is the last of them all. And we've decided that a grand movie theater, well, I don't think we have decided. I think the city decided for us that a grand movie theater is not part of our cultural core, and it's more interesting to have a high-rise in downtown Salt Lake City. Now, anytime I go to London or Paris or Rome, it's not the high-rises that were built in the last 10 years I go to see.
Oh boy, no kid. Isn't that so true? And, you know, here in America in general, our history doesn't go back, at least white settlement history doesn't go back to, you know, William the Conqueror and long before. You go over to London and you look at just the buildings that are still in use that go back 500 years, and they are still maintained, they are still used. And here, and especially out here in the West, again, when you're talking about things that are not Anasazi or are not Hopi or different things of that nature, but of the white settlers that came to the Intermountain West, anything that's 150 years old is older than dirt. And this theater is 101 years old, and it's amazing, with it being the last of the breed, one of the grandest of the grand theaters still in the entire country. And we're just going to plow that sucker over.
Yeah, and I certainly don't agree with that, and I wish there was an angle we could get into to still save it, but I don't see it. I don't know if there's a legal challenge that's possible because the city didn't do any proper request for proposals process. I'm not an attorney in that area, and certainly I haven't heard from any attorneys that think there is an angle there, but there are a number of people that are petitioning the Attorney General to look at this deal, and because I think it stinks all around, but yet there's no, they did not break the law in what they did.
Yeah, that's what's so hard right now. Quite often when we've talked about these things on my old show and on this show, we have a direction where we can steer people. You know, when something appears to have gone south, there often is recourse. And boy, that's what's so discouraging about this one. It looks like, again, our elected officials, on behalf of us, have done things technically within the legalities, and this appears to be a done deal. Other than reminisce and kind of cry in our beer, I don't quite know what to do.
No, and I'm with you as well. And the developer for LaSalle Properties, Joel LaSalle, bemoaned the fact that people had just come recently to try and save this theater. Well, I've been working since 2003 to try and save this theater. I tried to get Rick Howe to save this theater. I was one of the first people to put pictures of it up online for people to see what was actually inside. And I've been a member of the Utah Film Center Board for 15 years, and they did enormous amounts of studies about the need for a movie theater in our cultural core, and they worked with the county for that project in 2014, which the city completely eventually discarded.
Yeah, it is so difficult, and when you look at the old images, I'm looking at one right now. For anybody who would like to do this, all you have to do is just go online, and I'm looking at it. Really just kills me to see this, the grandeur of this theater, the incredible detail in the theater, the lobby and the stage and the terracotta and the stained glass, and you confirmed this last time we talked, the Tiffany glass ceiling that is in there. It's breathtaking. And is there anything within the plans, or is this maybe the last recourse we have to at least go in and try to salvage the ceiling and different things like that? I can't believe I'm talking. That just kills me. And when I brought this up, I'm also looking at the other theaters that have been saved. Ogden had the wisdom, thank heaven,
yes,
to save.
Done quite well with it.
To save the Egyptian Theater, which is truly wonderful. I love the Egyptian Theater. You look at how Murray right now is working. It's a city priority to save the old Murray Theater, and we're just plowing this sucker over.
Yeah, and the developer has talked about saving elements from the theater, but I feel like that's really dressing a corpse. I think it's really unfortunate that that's what the city council found important in their decision making is whether a developer could save bits and pieces of it to have on display for once, for if what was once there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, I did a real mistake here to actually bring up the images. And some of these are fairly recent. You can see some of the damage that has been done and so on. But so this isn't ancient in its true glory, but I'm looking at a picture right here of all of the beauty right around the ceiling and that glass. It's just breathtaking. Pete, the thing that's just killing me right now is that I don't have the recommendation for our listeners to make a phone call, sign a petition, do something. It's really distressing to talk about this with virtually nothing to do.
Well, and we have, I would argue that there is something to do. We have other historic properties that are going to be coming into question in the coming years. The Wasatch Plunge, the old spa out by the hot springs on Beck Street that used to
right.
be the children's museum, that's under question. The Fisher Mansion on the way out to the airport, you can see it from the freeway. The old public safety building where the cop shop used to be. These are all questions that we're going to be facing in the coming years, and I hope that the best proposal wins instead of somebody comes in and exclusively negotiates to demolish whatever those things
right.
are.
And, you know, lest somebody label us all as just old building huggers, you know, the fact is some buildings need to go. We get that. We understand that. But when you have a building that is proven to be salvageable and is so significant, to just let them slip into history this way, and then, you know, for years and years and years, we'll just go, wow, do you remember what that theater used to be? That's what's really, really tough.
It's the character of our city.
Yep.
And if we decide to destroy the character of our city, then we get what we deserve. And I don't think people want that. I think people want to remember the past and honor the past and honor our ancestors and keep Salt Lake interesting. Instead of a slate of glass wall as you walk down Main Street, I want to see shops and theaters and art museums.
Yep. And it's also just so, it just hurts so much when you see that other cities do place value on this. Other cities are going through and have gone through rather spectacular steps, like Ogden has done, like Murray is doing to save these grand old theaters. Pete, if nothing else, it's been good to share distress with a fellow lover of this old building, and I thank you for your efforts on this. I really do.
And yours as well.
Hey, thank you for being with us. Pete Ashdown, the thing that's just killing me here, so often when we've talked about these tough things, there has been a recourse. When we talked with Pete before, we still had the actual vote that we could steer people to. And this time, wow. I do have to give some credit where credit is due. Thankfully, years and years and years ago, we did save the old Capitol Theater, which was one of the grand old stage theaters, and I'm grateful for that. I don't want to overlook that, but leadership in the past saw what a grand old theater. I told this story last time we were discussing this. I had the chance to interview Debbie Reynolds, who, by the way, is as delightful in person as she is on the big screen or on the stage, and it was prior to her performance at the old Capitol Theater of the unsinkable Molly Brown. And after the performance, when she was getting, you know, standing ovations and the bouquet of roses and so on were being presented to her, I remember she stepped forward and she just looked around the theater. Everybody just, you know, stopped applauding for a moment. And she looked around the theater, looked up into the balcony, looked up at the amazing, amazing architecture. And she looked the audience straight in the eye and said, "Thank you for saving this grand old gal." I'll never forget that. And if I don't have each and every word absolutely perfect, it's certainly the spirit of what she said. And isn't that a shame that at some time, maybe 3, 4, 5 years into the future, we're not going to be able to have a performance there with a notable artist where we can all look around the old Utah Theater and say, "Thank heaven we saved this old gal." All right. When we come back, we'll share a few more thoughts on this. I'd be very interested to get your response And you can leave us your thoughts at the Utah Community Credit Union KSL text line at 57500. You can also leave us a message on our message line, which is 575-7668. So good to have you along on the program today. Thank you for joining us. By the way, as you have heard earlier today, Lee Lonsbury is in the building and will be doing this show beginning on Wednesday. It's been fun, and it's been an honor to kind of keep the seat warm for him. And so today and tomorrow, I'll be filling in, and then on Wednesday, Lee Lonsbury will be doing this radio program. You know, as I was complimenting Murray for their efforts that are underway as we speak to save the old Murray Theater, and then compliments to Ogden for what they did years ago, and they saved the Egyptian Theater. You know, up in Logan, they've done some great things, too. The Eccles Theater, I've seen presentations there, and especially now with my daughter-in-law coming from the Smithfield area, I've really, really kept a close eye on what's going on up there. And then there's also been a grand effort to save the, speaking of the Utah Theater up in Logan as well. And there's been a real effort. And it's sad that here in the capital city, we haven't been able to save one of our, and we did, thank heaven, we did. We saved one of our grand old stage theaters, the Capitol Theater. But unlike these other communities, it's a real shame that Salt Lake City, the capital city, the crossroads of the West, has somehow not had the gumption or the wherewithal to save one of not only the grandest theaters in Utah, but one of the grandest theaters in the country. And I think if I remember our conversation correctly when we talked with Pete Ashdown before, there, of all of the Pantages theaters, those grand old movie palaces that were out there, I think there were only three left. Two have been restored, and then ours was, we hoped, would be restored, but is not, and now the wrecking ball will find it. But wouldn't it be wonderful in downtown Salt Lake City if we could have the bragging rights to say, yeah, we had the foresight to save the old Capitol Theater, one of the great stage theaters of all time. And yeah, we had the wherewithal to build the beautiful new Eccles Theater in downtown, to have a modern, wonderful place that we can have some of the new productions that require bigger and better and more spacious things for all kinds of stage presentation. But we also had the wherewithal to save one of the truly grand movie theaters in existence today. The old Pantages, the old Utah Theater, and like our neighboring cities, like Ogden, like Murray, like Logan, we had the vision. We had the vision to save these grand old theaters for us, for our kids. And again, the punchline is I should be able to steer you somewhere. You know, there's still a chance. We can still save, but unfortunately, I'm just crying in my beer. Let's take a break, and we will, or my root beer, of course. Let's take a break. We'll come right by my Diet Coke. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with the mayor of Mill Creek, Utah. Jeff Silvestrini is coming up next.
The afternoon insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
A little later on in the program today, we're going to be talking with Fraser Bullock, and with the announcement that Russia is on the outs with major events in sporting, like little minor details like the Tokyo Olympics and so on. And not only that, but, you know, world-sanctioned games because of doping issues. We thought it would be an interesting conversation to have with Fraser Bullock about that, with all of his experience, not only in the 2002 Winter Olympics, but in trying to get the Olympics back to the state of Utah. And the Speaker of the House will be joining us, Brad Wilson, now that the tax reform package is taking more of a concrete presentation. We'll chat with him quickly. We'll also talk with the minority leader in the Senate about tax reform, especially with an eye toward toward protecting our schools and education. I'm very pleased that the mayor of Mill Creek, Utah, could join us today. Mayor Silvestrini, thank you for joining us today. Jeff, it's always good to have you on board.
Doug, it's great to talk to you as well.
We're kind of in a historical preservation mode today, and we talked a little earlier about the fate of the old Utah Theater, and it looks like it's kind of with a stake through its heart right now. And I couldn't help but see the article also, and since I was, at least from the time I was 10 years old forward, I was raised in Mill Creek, and I remember the old meeting house. That's how we know it now, but I remember it as the Winder Ward and everything else. I understand that that is perhaps on the docket for demolition. What's the deal on that, Jeff?
Well, and that's an unfortunate thing as well, Doug. Yeah, it is. The owner of the property has determined to redevelop that area. And our city tried to talk with three or four different potential owners of that property about trying to save that building in some way, because it does have historic value and it's kind of a landmark. A lot of people had weddings or wedding receptions there, even after it was no longer the Winder Ward. And it'll be a great loss, but it is owned in private ownership. And apparently it's going to take too much money to try to restore the building or save it, given the problems that it has. And at least that's what I'm informed by the owner of the property. So last week, our planning commission made an administrative decision to grant a conditional use permit to, permit something different to be built there. So,
what has the public reaction been, Mayor?
I'm sorry?
What has the public reaction been?
Well, we've had people come to planning commission meetings and community council meetings in Mill Creek and be concerned about the building. I'm sure that the public reaction is, does not favor it, being taken down in favor of another use. And it really is just a matter of if we could find funding to save it. It's the same kind of a story as the Utah Theater. There isn't money to save some of these old treasures. And people that own the property have a right to do something, make some beneficial use of their property. So,
we have talked over the years, even before Mill Creek was a city, Jeff, about where the epicenter of the city would be, where the city hall would be. And I understand that at one time this might have even been under consideration.
It was under consideration, Doug. We explored the possibility of either renting or purchasing that building for our city hall. And the preliminary investigations that we made revealed that it would just be too expensive to try to renovate that into a usable city hall space. And there were issues with the building. It's on an earthquake fault. It has, as I understand, problems with its foundation and mold and other problems that just would have made it too difficult to occupy that as a public building. So we abandoned that for some affordable rented space on 13th East and 33rd South.
Mm-hmm. And is this an absolute done deal now, Jeff, or are there any other options that is being considered by the city or by preservationists?
Well, what I can say is that our planning commission granted administrative approval in the form of a conditional use permit, which was necessary for the property owner to tear the building down and construct a new townhome development there. So as far as that permitting process has proceeded, yeah, that's a done deal. It's obviously up to the property owner to change course. And if there were, an offer made or, some ability to raise funding to do something to save that building, that would be up to that property owner to make that decision.
It is interesting because having been raised from the time I was 10 and a half years old forward in what is now Mill Creek City, it's such a beautiful, wonderful area, and there are many historic sites, but not a lot of real outstanding historic buildings. Certainly the Villa Theater would be one, the old meeting house would be one, the Gardner Mill just off of Highland Drive is one, and the list goes on. It's not like, it's a dearth of historic buildings, but they're not just everywhere. So when a historic building goes down in Mill Creek, it's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, let me say, are you there, Doug?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, in reaction to this kind of tragic situation that we are doing at Mill Creek is we're consulting with Preservation Utah about amending an ordinance. You know, we're a new city, so there are a lot of things that have been on our plate to try to, you know, get to. But historic preservation is something that has our attention. You know, I agree with you about the Villa Theater and other historic buildings in Mill Creek that they need to be preserved. So we are going to be working with Preservation Utah and other resources to fashion an ordinance for Mill Creek that will enable us to be able to do more than we are currently able to do with respect to the old meeting house.
I certainly appreciate that direction and that effort. And, you know, it's funny, you know, what becomes historic, and some of them are just beautiful old buildings like the old meeting house and grand old theaters, you know, like the Villa. And boy, thanks to Dr. Adib. I don't want him to take any heat here because, you know, he at least maintained the building. He at least maintained, although it's not fully lit, but he maintained the sign. He did do some ornamental things on the outside, which that's okay. But at least the building still stands and has been repurposed. And, you know, honestly, if sometime in the future somebody really wanted to turn it back into the Villa, well, yeah, you know, you'd have to do a lot of gutting, but it's at least still there. It is recognizable.
And I second that. And Dr. Adib has, I think, had an eye to preserving some of the, you know, interior of the building as well. I mean, most of it is the same as it was when I went to the Villa Theater and watched Star Wars and, you know, many other experiences. But I am also happy that he has an eye to preserving that building. And, you know, while it is repurposed, it's still a remarkable place to visit.
Yeah.
And, you know, would I like to see that be a, you know, put to a civic use or a theater someday? You bet. But I'm at least happy that Dr. Adib is doing what he's doing to save that great old landmark.
Now, Jeff, as I mentioned, you know, often we think of businesses and buildings, but I don't want to ever see what I always still think of the Dan, Phil, and Andy sign go away, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's the Trace Ombres sign now, but I love it, and I hope that thing never goes away.
I agree with you, and I really appreciate the humor that Don and Mike, the owners of Trace Ombres, exhibited in you know, repurposing that, if you will, to be you know, the signature thing for their business. And I will say, you know, just so that people understand Mill Creek's commitment to this, we advanced some funds from our community reinvestment area to get that sign working again. For a long time, it was not functioning, but a public-private partnership just to preserve that landmark in our city, we have had enabled it to be, you know, refurbished and working again. So I agree with you. That sign says Mill Creek like almost nothing else, right?
it really does. I'm not kidding you. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I was mesmerized by that sign. And when it was Carpet Town, it was Dan, Phil, and Andy in the old days. Jeff, just a couple of quick final questions. As you look around Mill Creek, and what a beautiful, wonderful area it truly is. But, you know, it was rural for such a long time. Then it was just pretty much, you know, housing for a long, long time in the area. So those buildings are treasures. What would you put on the docket for real serious consideration for being preserved in the future?
Well, for sure, the Villa Theater. You know, there's the Sue Rich Bowling Alley on Highland there.
Right.
In that vicinity, the Trace Ombres building is right there. And you know, then there's another landmark, the you know, the old laundry tower down at Artesian Springs, and that actually, you know, before Mill Creek became a city, the county was able to at least, you know, save that tower as a landmark and part of that project. So and you know what I would propose, Doug, is that we, you know, get a citizens preservation committee together, because there could be lots of opportunities that I'm not even aware of in our city. But I would like to have, you know, some public engagement and consensus on that by our residents to, you know, point out to us this should be saved, that should be saved. And obviously, you know, we have to, you know, balance all this with private property rights.
Sure.
and you know, what we can afford. But you know, definitely we need to focus on this and make sure that as our community, you know, grows and, you know, becomes a modern community, that we save the things that mark our past and that connect us to, you know, give us a sense of place about our community. you.
Jeff, just a quick update. We're talking with Mayor Jeff Silvestrini from Mill Creek. The wedge area that you and I have talked about before, kind of the, as it were, Mill Creek's downtown. How are things coming, and what are we going to be seeing happening soon?
So the city is in the process of acquiring a strip of land over the earthquake fault, the Wasatch Fault that runs through there, that our residents have kind of picked a name for it called Mill Creek Common. So we're in the process of purchasing the property under that, and we will be converting that into a public plaza park space. We're also in the process of planning that area with our community. We've had an online survey that's still open that our residents can access through our city website, millcreek.us. And we're soliciting ideas about what people want to see there. The timing on that is that we'll probably, you know, begin constructing that sometime as soon as we've acquired the property, but that could be as early as this spring sometime.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, I really appreciate the conversation. Isn't it interesting how when you go along Highland Drive for a long period of time, boy, you're basically on the fault itself, and it that presents some interesting opportunities. Well, mostly challenges, though, for a city like
it presents Mill Creek. Challenges, but they can be overcome. And yeah. You know, the key is good planning. Okay, and good planning, you know, preserves what's worth saving, and but also recognizes that as our state grows, you know, we have to adapt to that as well.
Absolutely, the mayor of Mill Creek, Utah, with us, Jeff. This is the last time I'll be talking to you during this radio show, but we'll look for some opportunities on TV. And I wish you and your family a great holiday season. All the great people there in Mill Creek.
Likewise to you, Doug. And I have enjoyed our conversations through the years, and I hope we can continue them in some way.
Absolutely, I'm sure we can. Right. Thank you so much, the mayor of Mill Creek, Utah. And that's Jeff Silvestrini. When we come back, we're going to talk about a new report that says, well, you know, the Justice Department was justified and not biased against Trump. Now, they made some mistakes, but boy, the president's had some reactions. We're going to get into that coming up next. Hey, be sure to join me, Movie Show Crew, coming up Friday. My hearing centers. Learn about the amazing new Sigma X hearing aid and find out how you could win a free pair from My Hearing Centers. Still to come on the program today, and I'm looking forward to the conversation with the Speaker of the House. Representative Brad Wilson will be joining us. We'll talk about the tax reform package. We'll also get the minority a point of view up on Capitol Hill with the minority leader in the Senate. Senator Karen Main will also be joining us. And right at the very, very end of the program, there was an interesting op-ed piece that was in the Salt Lake Tribune, and it was from Nicholas M. Bilagic, who is a Utah teacher, from what I understand, 20-some-odd years teaching for the Salt Lake City School District, I think. And this kind of hit a note with me, because I did serve on the task force from Envision Utah that looked into what is it going to take to keep teachers in the classroom? What is it going to take to not lose 50%? And this is a true statistic, 50% of our teachers at the 5-year, by the time they've been 5 years in the teaching profession, we lose half of our teachers. That is absolutely unacceptable. And one of the problems is while losing we're not getting the adequate number of teachers flowing in, and what is it going to take? And Mr. Bilagic, and I'll just quote directly, teachers don't want more money, they want more support. Interesting. And then he directly invokes Envision Utah. Envision Utah announced that it was going to study the teacher shortage and come up with recommendations. Envision Utah released results of their study, paid teachers a starting salary of $60,000. Veteran teacher would be paid as much as $110,000, estimated cost $500 million annually. And then he goes, how is this visionary? Well, you know, with all due respect, and I'm sure he's a wonderful teacher, and I think he makes a good point, the teachers do want more support. There was so much more to this conversation than just what salaries should be. All kinds of things, incentives, and scholarships and everything else and improving the working conditions and the very thing that he mentioned, they want more support. That is replete in the recommendations. I know I was there and participated in every meeting save one, and I sent my wife, Dee, who works in education, to represent me at the one meeting that I could not attend. But I don't want to belittle what Mr. Bilogic said, because he is right. Not right that teachers don't want more money. More money is essential. And I always hear this term, just throwing money at education isn't the answer. I agree with that. But strategic use of money in education is absolutely part of the answer. And so we're going to talk a little later on with Erin Burchill, who was Utah's 2008 Teacher of the Year. She happens to teach at Uinta High School. She was on the task force. And we're going to talk about some of the things that will make a difference. And again, I respect and I appreciate Mr. Bilogic's comments. And I hope I'm saying his name right. Anytime you string more than four consonants together in a name, I struggle a little bit. But when I read this part, and the headline is, Utah teachers don't need more money, they need more help. That was the headline in the Tribune. In the body of the argument, teachers don't want more money, they want more support. The last part of that is absolutely true. The first part of that I am uncomfortable with. Teachers both need more money and teachers want more money, and we'll talk about that coming up. Okay, the report is out. This is the headline from NBC News. International Justice Watchdog finds that the Russia probe was justified and not biased against Trump. Just to get into a little more detail, now this is the opening line of the NBC report. The FBI mishandled parts of its application to monitor a Trump campaign ad as it was probing possible Russian interference in the 2016 election. But the overall investigation was justified, according to the long-awaited report by the Justice Department's watchdog that rebuts the president's depiction of a politically biased plot against him. The Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz concluded that the FBI and the Justice Department launched their investigation into the 2016 campaign not for political reasons, but because of evidence the Russian government was using cutouts to reach out to the Trump campaign as part of its efforts to influence the election. Horowitz found that the political bias did not taint the actions of former FBI leaders who have frequently been subjected to presidential attacks. The report says, and I'm quoting here, "We did not find documentary or testimonial evidence that political bias or improper motivation influenced the decisions to open the investigation into four Trump campaign ads," the report says. So how did the president react to that? Well, let's listen to it. Gustavo, let's listen to that in his own words.
"And I was just briefed on it, and it's a disgrace what's happened with respect to the things that were done to our country. It should never again happen to another president. It's a very sad day when I see that. Very sad day when a lot of people see that. They have known nothing. It was concocted. And you say what you want. That was a probably something that's never happened in the history of our country."
The president obviously not buying the internal justice department probe, and he said they fabricated evidence and they lied to the court. This is what he told reporters today before a roundtable discussion on education. "This was an attempt to overthrow, and a lot of people were in on it, and they got caught." Rather interesting response from the president, but again, the bottom line from the report, and it's a lengthy report, I think, what did I read, 500 pages or something, that said, "We did not find documentary or testimonial evidence that the political bias or improper motivation influenced the decisions." All right, on that note, let's take a brief break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Fraser Bullock, who was so instrumental in the success of the 2002 Winter Olympics here in the state of Utah and has been very instrumental in looking forward to perhaps another encore for the state of Utah. His reaction to Russia and the sports ban. We'll give you the details on that coming up.
Insights and analysis continue. Here's Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
Over the weekend when I was reading about this, boy, it got my attention. The World Anti-Doping Agency, yes, there is indeed such a thing, has slapped Russia with a four-year ban from international sports events, including next summer's Tokyo Olympics. This has been a long-standing doping scandal. Its athletes, however, will still be able to compete if they can show that they are clean competitors. This means that Russia's flag, name, anthem will not appear at the Tokyo Games, and the country could also be stripped of hosting world championships in the Olympic sports. And what's interesting, as harsh as that seems, the World Doping Organization, the agency, anti-doping agency, has said this was flagrant manipulation, an insult to the sporting movement worldwide. That was the IOC. And then the World Anti-Doping Agency is really upset about the inability to fully expel Russia from the Tokyo Olympics and the 2022 Beijing Winter Games, frustrated that the doping watchdog's vice president said, "I'm not happy with the decision we made today, but this is as far as we could go." I thought it would be most interesting to get Fraser Bullock's take on this, of course, so instrumental in the success and all the hard work on the 2002 Winter Olympic Games right here in Utah, and of course, very prominent in business circles in the state, and also looking forward to future Olympics. And Fraser, as always, thank you so much for taking our call.
A pleasure to be with you again, Doug.
What's your reaction to this?
Well, it is long overdue. Russia, going back to Sochi, had blatant violations. There were some restrictions put on them for Rio and again for Pyeongchang. But what's interesting about this is a recent violation of data manipulation, such that what they're trying to do is protect some of their athletes from violations in the past so that they could compete in the future. And as a result of manipulating, once again, data or violating the rules, they have really created a troubling situation for the sporting world. Because we all want clean athletes. We want clean competitions. And here is Russia once again violating the rules of competition. It's very sad, but it's good to see the enforcement that is taking place under the auspices of WADA.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, everybody's had some issues at one time or another in one arena or another, but it seems to be such a consistent thing. When I was a kid, it was always, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries. There were questions even of gender participation sometimes. There were sketchy things happening all over the place. And it just seems to continue on. And if there is one consistent, again, not saying that everybody is absolutely guilt-free except what used to be the old USSR and the satellite countries, but there are some common denominators that have gone on not just for years, but for decades and decades.
Yes, and the claim here and the belief here by those enforcing this ban is that this is state-sponsored. This is not an individual like the Balco labs that we had in the U.S. This is claimed to be sponsored by Russia itself, where the government is involved and people of the government are pushing this forward to make this happen. That's the most troubling element of these claims against Russia, and which appear to be true. And so you have to have the most stringent of enforcement or bans in this case.
I always feel sorry for the clean athlete, the one and that is really trying to do the right thing. And often the athletes pay a price either for politics that is going on or, you know, missteps by others. Often they are guilty, certainly themselves. I think of our athletes years ago when Jimmy Carter decided to not have us participate in the Olympics. I actually knew some of the Olympians who had been training for years to participate in that. But as I understand it, athletes from Russia will be allowed to compete in the major events only if they are not implicated basically in any way, positive doping tests, or if it can be proven their data was not manipulated, as you have alluded to basically make them look clean when they're not.
Exactly. So let me comment on the first part of that. I was with a Winter Olympian, a former Winter Olympian, just a few weeks ago, who came in fourth in one of her competitions in the Olympics. And she highly suspected that one or two of the people who won medals were doping. And so here you have an individual who never medaled, who trained her entire life, tried to play by the rules, and was denied an Olympic medal because of cheating.
Yeah.
That's what we've got to avoid. That's why we have to have clean athletes, because we want to set these standards. And what's troubling about this ban, yes, it is a ban against Russia and its flag being there, but there are many Russian athletes who can participate. They are called Olympic athletes from Russia, or OAR, is what happened in Pyeongchang. But what's troubling about that is Russia did not come clean with the data on these athletes. And so we don't know if they're clean or not. And that is the most troubling part of that. And that's why certain people within WADA wanted to go further than just a country ban.
Yeah. What effect does this have on the Olympics? You have been steeped in this movement. You've seen the tough days here in Utah. You saw the ultimate glory, one of the finest presentations of the Winter Olympic Games in its modern history. And you've looked forward to perhaps even the event coming back to the state of Utah. What effect does this type of stuff have on the overall image of the Olympics?
Well, you want the Olympics to stand for something, which is world, as much as we can, unifying the world under the umbrella of sport, bringing the world together. And in doing so, you want it to be clean and have this wonderful image. So this is a step that can be celebrated to hopefully, by the time we host again, whenever that is, that the games are clean and that this is an important step forward to push forward towards that, to send the clear message that cheaters will not be tolerated, because we owe it to the clean athletes and the image of the Olympics and the world coming together in such a way that we can celebrate human achievement and not be wondering about the cheaters.
Yeah. Any update for us quickly? We'll end on a positive note, hopefully, that we'd all, at least I would love to see the Olympics come back to the great state of Utah. Anything going on behind the scenes?
Well, a lot has happened, actually. Recently, the International Olympic Committee changed its Olympic charter, so the bidding process has been completely revamped. And it's more of a partnership. There's not a calendar. There's not this competition against other cities. And that was passed this summer. And so now the IOC will be working with interested cities to partner with them and say what time frame makes sense for you, and let's collaborate. And so that's very exciting. So no definitive date for us has been set to bid for at this point, but we continue to move forward, explore alternatives, and have a dialogue in the not-too-distant future with the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee and the IOC in the not-too-distant future. But the trend is very positive towards partnership and no definitive timeframes for bidding.
Well, that's a good thing to hear. That is a good thing to hear. Frazier, thank you so much. Thanks for your friendship. Thanks for all the great work you've done in this arena and more. And I wish you and your great family a very, very happy holiday season.
And same to you, Doug. I appreciate all you do.
Fraser Bullock with us here at KSL News Radio. Next, the Speaker of the House will join us. We switch topics to tax reform, and we're getting very, very close. And I'll be asking the Speaker about this. Is it a done deal? Is it for sure? Do we have a special... I've tried to nail everybody down on this, and everybody's kind of done the fancy dance on me, but I think we're going to have a special session on the 12th. We'll get him to confirm it coming up next. I'm really looking forward to our conversation with the Speaker of the House here in the state of Utah. And Representative Speaker Brad Wilson is on the line with us. And Brad, gosh, it's too bad you can't find a few things to put on your plate. I don't know what you're doing with your time nowadays.
Good afternoon, Doug. It is a busy time of year.
It truly is in every sense of the word, and I know I'm obviously being facetious, but good grief, you know, the trying to iron out reformation on Utah's tax code and to look at the facts. I mean, just look at the way we're all shopping this holiday season. Look at the way we conduct business. Look at the way we buy things. Look at the more fuel-efficient vehicles that we are all driving, almost without exception. And it's really incredible, and this has caused a real opportunity and some challenges with the state tax taxing code. So, first of all, let me ask you the straight-up question. Are we going to have the special session on the 12th?
I believe so. Yeah, the governor will ultimately make that call, and hopefully we can get together with him tomorrow and get that put together. But that's my hope. I think it would be good for the state and the citizens in particular, because we like to get a pretty sizable tax cut in place and fix this challenge with our budget at the same time.
In your op-ed piece in the Deseret News, you laid out the six key elements for the tax proposal. For those who perhaps have not heard it discussed or did not read this, what do we need to do? What are the six things that you hope to really accomplish here?
Yeah, well, the major themes of this include providing a tax cut for Utah families, a pretty sizable one, actually, $160 million, almost $200 million, really, for Utahns, because as we shift some tax from income tax to sales tax, we pick up out-of-staters paying a good portion of that, so that's nice. And we also restore the dependent exemptions that were lost a few years ago when the federal government and Congress made some tax changes to the state. We do a number of other sort of important things. We install a food credit. We put the full sales tax back on food. It's only at about 1.7% right now. But all of these things help shore up our general fund so that we have the ability to continue to invest in the types of services that we think government should provide. You know, we're so blessed to live here, and we want to have transportation services. We care about our environmental needs here in the state, and as we've spent our money differently, our tax collection for the state has changed. We're just trying to fix that a little bit, but also cut taxes, and it seems to be going in the right direction.
Before we bring up the E word, education, I wanted to just for my own well-being explore a couple of things. Putting the full sales tax back on unprepared food, and you know, I really get that. I really do. I don't even notice it. I mean, I'm sure when Gail Miller shops, when, you know, whomever is out there shopping, for the vast majority of it, I think if you ask the average Utahn, unless they really do remember when this actually occurred, they'd go, oh, really? I didn't even know that. But there are those for whom this does make a difference. And how are they being protected, Brad?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, like, for example, really well-paid radio hosts
you would obviously be talking about Jeff Kaplan here.
Oh, well, I'm talking about you.
Oh!
You know, are not paying the full sales tax on food, but yet, you know, you probably can afford it. And but so what we're doing in this bill is we're reducing the overall income tax rate for everyone, but we're also taking, even though the full sales tax goes back on food, we're providing a credit to families that are really under about $70,000 a year for all the members of their family that helps more than offset the additional sales tax that they will be paying under this bill. And so, for example, those under $30,000 a year in household income, we think that right now they have about a $30 million benefit with lower sales tax on food. Through this bill, we're actually doubling that benefit to them to somewhere in the neighborhood of $65 million of credits. So it's actually a much more targeted approach to helping those at the lower income levels, and we do it in this package.
You know, Mr. Speaker, there was something else that didn't dawn on me, because I initially supported the reduction, because, boy, it sounds really good, and I still am very concerned about those who are the poorest among us, that they really do get the benefit. But it hadn't even occurred to me when our visitors and out-of-staters and when people are here and they're staying in their condo for a week at Deer Valley, you know, they're getting that same break as well. And then the other thing that I was wondering, and this kind of ties into another question that I have on the income tax credit for Social Security retirement income, for both of those things, if people are not filing their income tax for whatever reason, do they not get either break?
Yeah, good question. So they're actually it's a refundable credit. And so if you are below an income level where you are required and need to file an income tax return, you actually could take this one-page form and still file to receive this credit. And so you don't have to have an income tax return to receive the credit, but you do. I think it's a reasonable ask.
Mm-hmm.
You do need to fill out a one-pager and send it into the tax commission.
Will word get out? Sometimes I think we forget language issues and things like that. People who are kind of newly in either an age bracket or a category bracket where they would qualify for this, will there be a real vigorous outreach to these folks?
Yeah, you'll see we've actually had these conversations. You'll see a combined effort from the Department of Workforce Services and the Tax Commission to do an information and a public outreach campaign, and also ensure that those that need help navigating how to fill out this one-page form can get that done.
The funding for higher education and education in general, Mr. Speaker, are you absolutely convinced and can assure everybody that education will not only be held harmless, but will get even additional funds, which has been an effort of many, including people that have held your position in the past, like Nolan Karras, who was our speaker years ago, our former president of the Senate, Lane Beatty, and others who now in a more business capacity are really working with, I mentioned Gail Miller earlier, Scott Anderson. Boy, the list of notables goes on and on and on, that we not only need what we've got to have some serious input of even new and fresh money into education.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I actually participated this morning with the governor and Senate president in talking about how we need to put more money specifically into computer science programs
mm-hmm.
here in the state.
That was $4 million, wasn't it, that you set aside?
Well, the governor's asking for the legislature to appropriate $10 million with a $4 million match from the private sector. And, you know, I think those are great needs and great, very important programs that we need to be looking at putting additional new money into. And the answer, the simple answer to your question is yes. Public education will not only be held harmless, but we will continue to invest in the growth and needs of our public education system. The reality of this bill is all it does is it takes a dollar of sales tax money. It's actually $530 million of income tax money out of higher education and replaces it with $530 million of sales tax money. And the governor said this to me this morning, but it's just as easy to spend a dollar that comes from sales tax as it is to spend a dollar that comes from income tax. And that's exactly what's happening here. Nothing more, nothing less.
The constitutional amendment to change the earmark for education that goes back, I believe, to 1930, is that part of what you will discuss if indeed
no.
the...
No, we may have that conversation. In fact, I think we will have that conversation during the general session. But the structural fix that we're contemplating doing later this week in a special session is a separate issue than eliminating the constitutional earmark for income tax. But
But I think it's a good question to ask, and I understand why those of us that, and I put me in this camp, that care a lot about public education, have concerns about eliminating the earmark that says all income tax in Utah must go to public education and it can't be spent on anything else. I understand why you wouldn't want to give that up. But I think it's also fair we ask a different question, which is, has it worked? Has it helped us in a meaningful way if we're trying to determine outcomes in terms of public education or even just spending? The earmark has taken us from 50th in per pupil spending to 50th. And so maybe it's time we have a conversation here in the state of Utah about, is there a better way to fund public education that gives public education more stability and more certainty over time? And I think we'll have those conversations over the next year.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for making time today. There are a gazillion questions, but I know a lot of things are still moving parts. It will be most interesting to see what happens if indeed the special session moves forward on the 12th. I'll look forward to opportunities. This will be the last time I'll be chatting to you on the radio program. Lee Lonsbury will take this show on Wednesday, but we'll pick on you on TV occasionally, okay?
Well, that'd be great, Doug, and it's always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks so much. Speaker of the House here in the state of Utah, Representative Brad Wilson. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we will talk with the minority leader in the Utah State Senate. We'll be talking with Senator Karen Maine. Stay with us.
More afternoon news and in-depth coverage with Doug Wright on KSL News Radio.
We talked with the Speaker of the House just a moment ago. I appreciate Brad Wilson joining us. And as we anticipate, and when I talked to Speaker Wilson, I said, are we going to have a special session on the 12th? And he goes, I hope so. And we're waiting for the governor and so on. So even at this stage of the game, we don't have the definitive, the flag has not officially dropped, but we're all assuming that it will. And in light of some of the things that are beginning to seemingly solidify, one of them, at least for the special session, seems not to be changing the Constitution of the great state of Utah and the earmark on our income tax that sends it all to public and higher education. I thought this would be a good day to talk with the Speaker and also talk with the minority leader in the Utah State Senate. Senator Karen Maine is on the line with us. And Senator, once again, thank you for joining us. You've been great to take our phone calls. Are you hearing any definitive rumblings at all on the special session?
Well, you know, I'll bet you lunch. How's that? That we're going to have something this week. And if you've talked to the Speaker, I think he pretty well knows the direction we're going.
Yeah, I think there will be. I think everybody's just being careful and deflecting and being respectful of the governor and his ability to actually, you know, call the game, as it were. As you now see things solidifying, and Speaker Wilson, in an op-ed piece in the Deseret News, laid out some of it. He's laid it out also on the airwaves, that giving a tax cut of roughly $160 million, that's more than we had anticipated. Apparently that is backed by the governor, providing a targeted grocery credit to low-income households in regards to the full sales tax back on unprepared food. The tax credit for dependents that was eliminated by Congress in 2017, strengthening that tax credit, the income tax credit for Social Security retirement income, investing in the state highways and transit, reducing the burden on the general fund, and moving more funding of higher education to the sales tax bracket. What's your first blush reaction to what is likely to be the agenda for Wednesday?
I think we have a meeting tonight, and I think we'll there will be things aired tonight, you know, at 5 o'clock. And the agenda, I don't know. I have a guess to that, and so do you, which is going to be on the call. But tonight, the meeting that's going to be aired, I think that's where we're going to see. I've just talked to one of the chairs, and he has a conversation, and he's has some things he wants to address to us. But this is the same song that you and I have spoken about. We're very concerned of not protecting those educational funds, very concerned that we have tax on food, those things that we hold dear. we have not the we haven't broadened or in the stability of the sales tax. Those we've had those services that were a large display, and now it's down to a small amount. So those that were we had conversation about putting more taxes on services, that's dwindled. So that's what puts more pressure pressure on the food tax. We don't see that that services have not been taxed enough, if that's where they want it to go. We're concerned that those education dollars are not protected. We're concerned that those the sales tax monies from the liquor, where are they going to go? Are those funding, the funding for the children to make sure that they have food for breakfast and for lunch, those things we don't see the roadblocks and those things that need to be in place so we can be there.
There are some specifics that I asked of the speaker that I'd like to ask of you, but I think I said Wednesday, I meant Thursday. That's the anticipated day for the special session on the 12th. I asked the speaker about the sales tax, the full sales tax going back on unprepared food, and then also tied it into a credit for him on the income tax credit for Social Security retirement income. And something that you and I have discussed and I've discussed with others, that this does require people to actually file their income tax, be in the loop enough to be, or the age or whatever, if they're going to get that kind of break. I asked the speaker about the outreach to make sure that people really understood that. I mean, there are those that consciously file their taxes each and every year, and unless maybe they have an enlightened tax preparer or somebody whispering in their ear, they might not be aware of this. Is there enough outreach on this? Will people know they can get a break?
Doug, there is a huge hole in this whole issue and formula that they have brought forth. Those people that do not file taxes, there's many people that the income is not high enough. They're doing what they need to do. They take care of business. They live, but they don't reach that level for them to file income tax. They're not going to be reached. And those are the ones that need that credit. That's why we go back. There's very few states that tax food. If they do, it's some kind of formula that's put in place for a different kind of products they tax. That's what we're concerned about. People that get it, that file income tax, they're going to have to wait a whole year. So when they need it that month, they're not going to get a paycheck till the end of the year. And those that do not file income tax, there's this huge gap. Those are the ones that need it, and those are the ones that we're not going to find.
The speaker mentioned a one-page in lieu of filing taxes document that could be filed that would make them eligible for these breaks. Are you confident that, first of all, that is happening, second of all, that it will work?
I think that that's a gesture. I don't think it's going to work. I think the outreach, how much is that outreach going to cost to try to reach those people? They've spoken about the senior citizens and those kind of things to be nurtured into that in that formula. Maybe, but it's a lot of preparation where we're not going to capture those people. So we're trying to make a formula that serves everyone. It's not going to be there. I don't think what they have in place, and I appreciate the gesture of that, it's not going to give those people the money they need. We need it up front every time they go to the store. We do not need to tax them. We're taking money from them. And we have no way to replace that at the end of the year. So those people, I feel, hopefully, that we can have a formula that does do something. We're very fearful this is not the answer. We're just trying to put bandages to make the tax on food look better or maybe more comfortable with. We do not feel it should be in place. Like I say, very few states do that.
I asked the speaker about the constitutional amendment that has been rumbling around, and he seemed to think that that would not happen during a special session, but certainly did not close the door to it. Is this something that Are you hearing the same thing, that that's not going to be a topic for the special session? And if not, when do you think that it will raise its head?
I think that if you spoke to the speaker, probably we'll have to wait to see what's on the call. And that conversation will be interesting when that's brought up. I don't know, but how are they going to, how are we going to make that happen? So that's for us to how are they going to do that? We'll have to wait and see. And we have, you know, how we feel about that. We want to make sure that those education dollars are protected.
Senator Maine, I've appreciated you joining us. Thank you so much. We'll look for an opportunity since Lee Lonsberry will be taking this time slot coming up on Wednesday. We'll look for an opportunity to chat with you on TV sometime soon and get your reaction, and I certainly appreciate your willingness to join us. Thank you. Senator Karen Maine with us, who is the minority leader up on Utah's Capitol Hill. I want to remind you, you can take KSL wherever you go. Listen live and on demand. Download the KSL News Radio app. It's powered by our friends at Any Hour Services. Now, coming up next, and this was prompted by an opinion piece in the Salt Lake Tribune, where, and again, I hope I'm pronouncing this name correctly, Nicholas M. Bilogic, one of our great Utah teachers, teaches in the Salt Lake District, if I remember correctly, for 20-plus years, made this statement, and I wanted to flesh it out. Teachers don't want more money. This is a quote. Teachers don't want more money. They want more support. I would absolutely agree with the tail end of that comment, but not the first part. I'd like to hear from you, and we're going to talk with Utah's Teacher of the Year about this issue coming up here at KSL. Well, it's good to have you along on the program, and I wanted to set the stage for this conversation. I've had the opportunity several times to do that during the course of the show today, but this headline in the Salt Lake Tribune, Utah teachers don't need more money, they need more help. And this was an op-ed piece by a teacher in the Salt Lake City School District, Nicholas M. Bilogic. And I hope I'm saying that right, as I've joked about, whenever there are more than four consonants in a row, I question my ability to properly pronounce it, but I'm giving it a good shot. I greatly admire, apparently, this highly, I don't know him, but esteemed teacher, someone who cares a great deal. But when I was reading in his opinion piece, the teachers don't want more money, they want more support, I agree with the latter wholeheartedly. But I also agree with the preceding part that teachers do need more money. And it was worded two different ways. Up at the top in the headline, Utah teachers don't need more money. And then in the text of his comment, teachers don't want more money. I would argue it's both. They not only need more money, they want more money. And the concept of, and I've heard this over and over, just throwing money at education isn't going to solve it. No, that's true. Absolutely true. But targeted precision money in the business of educating, I argue would make a huge difference. And then he also took on Envision Utah, announcing that it was going to study the teacher shortage, which indeed we did. I'll include myself in that. I'll include our guest, who is Aaron Burchill, Utah's Teacher of the Year in 2018. And it made it look like, in the opinion piece, that the only thing we talked about and the only thing we advocated was dramatically increasing what teachers make. And Aaron, first of all, thank you for joining us. Utah Teacher of the Year. You went to high school. That wasn't it at all. We certainly talked about what teachers need and want when it comes to dollar amounts, but we did talk about everything else as well, the environment in which they work, the prestige and the respect for it, the support of it, maybe encouraging people to go in at a very, very early stage of their education by offering scholarships. I mean, I don't know how many meetings we had on this. Maybe you recall.
We had a lot of different meetings, and those meetings extended beyond the actual physical meetings that we had with each other. And I have to say, I felt a lot of responsibility as being one of the few teacher voices in that incredible think tank of innovative people to represent the viewpoint and the realities of being a teacher. And I took that pretty seriously. And maybe you're in some of those meetings where I was pretty clear about the need for support. I shared a lot of my own experiences to try to give a sense of reality of what it's like in the day-to-day workings as a teacher. But absolutely, this is more than just, hey, we want to be paid more and walk out the door. We're done. We finished having the conversation.
Yeah.
This was multi-layered through many different perspectives. And I would say, absolutely, I agree with you that teachers do need to be paid more, and absolutely teachers need more support.
Absolutely.
And that is one of the conversations that I think that if you read the whole Envision Utah report, you can see that those layers of support are built into the perspective. But I think the conversation people mostly want to talk about is, you know, the starting salary of $60,000 and the estimated cost of $500 million, and they just wanted to make it a simplistic issue. We all know that education is a complex issue with a lot of emotion, because this is our kids we're talking about. And so it's easy to make this into a line item conversation. But this is a conversation that we want to keep having in Utah, because we want to improve the outcomes for our kids and our economy and our quality of life that we have here in Utah. And that all stems from education.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the respect for the profession, the sacrifices that are made within the profession, the importance of the profession, and trying to do something that will keep us from losing 50% of our teachers by the five-year mark. And I thought some incredibly innovative things were brought up, and I so appreciated the voices of the educators that were there. Yourself, we had a superintendent of one of our school districts. We had the person over the superintendent association. We had the UEA who was represented, and even some of us who don't have the teacher credentials, we are steeped in it. My mother was a teacher for 33 years. My wife works in education. Everybody in her family, educators, and I learned so much in those meetings. What are you hoping for that will come from? And again, Envision Utah has no power other than to make suggestions and put goodly efforts, and has the clout to bring in some rather interesting folks to the table that otherwise nobody could ever afford. And, you know, what do you hope will come of these many recommendations that go above and beyond certainly just dollars?
Yes. Well, I feel like one of the conversations that was missed in this op-ed, yes, we're losing teachers at 50%. But my main concern, and I think this is a concern of a lot of our conversations, you know, with all these meetings with Envision Utah, is just the fact that we don't have enough kids who even want to go into this profession, let alone stay in this profession. So that was where a lot of this, we need additional funding, comes from, because we need people to say, wow, this is an actual profession that has a living wage that I could envision myself going and doing for the next 30, 35 years and really making a difference in the world. We talked about having scholarships that make it so more likely that we can have a diverse population, because we know that when we have more teachers of color, that improves the entire school system. We want to have students who are maybe in other areas and like STEM subjects and science and math. We want some of those brilliant minds to stay in education and really nurture the next level of brilliant minds.
Right.
And so it's more than keeping what we've got. It's about nurturing what we need.
Erin, I really appreciate you. I know you've been teaching today. You took time to join us in a very busy schedule. Thank you for giving us your perspective. We so appreciate it. I appreciated your comments in our multiple meetings. I wish you well, and we'll look for other opportunities to chat as well. That's Erin Burchill, who was the 2018 Teacher of the Year here in the state of Utah, teaches at Uinta High School. Thanks so much for being part of the show. Tomorrow I'll be back at 12:30. That'll be a swan song making the way for Lee Lonsbury, who takes the reins on Wednesday.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLPodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.